World Affairs Report, 30 minutes of conversation designed to make you better aware of the world around you. The World Affairs Report is brought to you by the World Affairs Council of Pittsburgh in cooperation with KQV News Radio. The World Affairs Council is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that has been bringing the world to Pittsburgh for over 80 years. To learn more about the council and upcoming events, please visit worldpittsburgh.org. And now, the World Affairs Report.
Hello, everyone. I'm your host, Angelico Campo. Thanks so much for joining us again. Today, we want to revisit a topic that we have covered in the last month or so, which is Turkey and the different political upheavals that have been occurring in the country. Thanks to the support of the Turkish Cultural Center of Pittsburgh, we have a great guest today who has come to Pittsburgh from D.C. just to be here with us today, to have an event where he will be talking to students and to the community at large. And we are very thankful to the Turkish Cultural Center and also to our guests for being here today. Our guest is Mahir Zeynalov. Mahir, welcome.
Great to be here.
Welcome to Pittsburgh and welcome to the show. Mahir is a Turkish journalist and analyst based in Washington, D.C. He's the editor-in-chief of the Globe Post magazine and has previously worked at the Los Angeles Times and also the Turkish newspaper Zaman. And that was until the Turkish government shut it down in 2016. He's writing columns for Al Arabiya and regularly contributing to the Huffington Post. He's the first journalist in Turkey asked by Erdogan to be imprisoned. And he's also the first journalist to be deported from Turkey. He's a frequent commentator on developments related to Turkey in world major TV channels, including CNN, BBC, Al Jazeera, and NBC. And he's best known for documenting the massive crackdown on Turkish journalists and for reporting on the ongoing crackdown in Turkey. So once again, it's an honor to have you with us today.
Thanks for having me.
So before we go into the more recent events, why don't we do a little bit of history and why don't you walk us through the recent political history in Turkey? When did President Erdogan come to power?
Well, President Erdogan came to power 14 years ago against the backdrop of a country that was in shambles, basically. In the decade preceding his rule, we had, I think, like nearly 10 governments, coalition governments. There was absolutely political turbulence and two devastating economic crises. So people were suffering, and we survived a devastating earthquake that killed more than 17,000 people in Istanbul. It's the biggest financial city in Turkey. And when Erdogan came to power, all other parties, you know, fared badly. And that helped him to secure the rule single-handedly and have this majority in the parliament. So because Turkey is a parliament, actually it was a parliamentary democracy, the party that secured the most votes in parliament also elected a prime minister. And Erdogan ruled until 2014 as a prime minister, and he was elected as a president in 2014, and they changed the system just last month, giving him more presidential powers.
And we'll get to that in a moment.
Sure.
But tell us what happened in July of 2016, last year.
Right. Well, Turkey is no stranger to military coups. And the country that Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, he is the founder of the secular modern Turkish Republic in 1923. He was a military general. And when he established the Turkey, he also put the Turkish military as guardian of secularism, which they believed was the cornerstone of democracy. And for many, many decades, when the military saw a government that was more Islamist or more leftist during the Cold War, they toppled those governments. And we have seen these four full-fledged military coup d'etat in the past, since 1960. And the last one was in 1997, when the military forced the civilian government, which was an Islamist government, to resign. And Erdogan actually was part of that government. He was mayor of Istanbul, and he actually spent in jail for 3 months for reciting a poem during a rally. So when that party was banned by the military, by the military-backed courts, Erdogan founded a new party called the Justice and Development Party in 2001. It was a brand new party, and in 16 months, his party did a very good job. It was refined from the debris of the banned Islamist party. And in initial years of President Erdogan's power, he lifted millions of people out of poverty, and he started the membership negotiations with the European Union because they believe that, look, I mean, whatever government we elect, the military topples them because they see us as conservative, you know, pious, you know, people. And they are very skeptic that, you know, we'll bring back, you know, Islamist rule here. So what we gotta do is we have to curb the role of military in politics. And the way to do that is to become the member of the European Union, that the Brussels would put pressure on Turkey to send the military back to the barracks and limit its role in politics. And also, reform Turkish judiciary in line with the European Union. And that was a judiciary that backed by the military and jailed Erdogan himself. So as Erdogan eliminated all these, you know, hostile powers, including the military and judiciary, and consolidated his power in like 2011 when he was elected like for the third time with like 50% of the vote, which is unprecedented given that, you know, in parliamentary democracies you have only like 20-30% of the votes you get to become the government, and since then there were no any you know, checks and balances that would put Erdogan's uncontrolled power in check.
It was a slow erosion.
It
we
was.
Could say of control of checks and balances at that point.
Right. Well, coming to your question about the military coup.
Right.
As I said, I mean, that was not Turkey is not a stranger to military coup. So when in like 5 or 6 years, when Erdogan went astray and also reneged in his promise to bring democracy to Turkey and become make Turkey a member of the European Union. The military saw that there was an, as you said, erosion of democracy, dramatic decline, and the freedoms and civil liberties were routinely violated. There was a huge corruption scandal that Erdogan and his government buried. There were also a lot of problems regarding the judiciary and the media freedom. There were a lot of journalists jailed, including a lot of my friends. I myself was asked by President Erdogan to be imprisoned in late 2013. So the military thought that they could again topple the government. But what happened? What we have seen in July last year was not a typical military coup attempt. It was a night of violence, a night of terror, that those coup plotters bombed Turkish parliament. Why would you bomb a parliament, in the symbol of Turkish national unity, when you want to win minds and hearts of the people? And they occupied a bridge in Istanbul, and they you know, killed police officers and bombed, you know, areas that I would call a stupid attempt, you know, just to make sure that the people don't like them and they don't get the support. So it doesn't make any sense, and there are a lot of questions than answers. Why a one small faction within the military would try to topple the government and do such a bad job? And there are several steps that you have to realize for successful military coup attempt. If you Google it, like military coup 101, you would find those. It's like, you know, cut the internet, right? Control the message, control the narrative. This was not done. Arrest politicians. This was not done.
So what you're telling us is this is a questionable.
It is questionable.
It's not necessarily failed. Maybe it was a successful questionable attempt.
Right. I mean, there's no way that the Turkish military would try to attempt a military coup and they would fail. I mean, our military is very professional at that. We have been doing this like once in every decade. So it's inconceivable to think that the military would plan anything like that and it will be failed. It's so obvious that the Turkish government intercepted some of the communications before the military coup took place and tried to undermine it through political maneuvering. And there was a Russian group within the military called the so-called the Perinçek group. And, you know, Turkey and Russia were at each other's throats because Turkey shot down a Russian warplane back in 2015. Just 2 weeks before the military coup attempt, President Erdogan wrote a letter to President of Russia, Vladimir Putin, and apologizing for shooting down the plane. securing the pro-Russian group within the Turkish military. And I think they were key when they withdrew their support from the initial military coup attempt. That's the reason why they failed, because most of the coup was executed by pilots and air forces. And perhaps they thought that the land forces would be the major driving force in the military coup. And when they didn't show up, it just, you know, failed miserably.
Now, one way or the other, whatever the origins were, what were the consequences of this night of terror, as
right.
you've called it?
Well, it seems that, you know, a failed coup attempt is as bad as what a successful military coup would be. And since the turmoil that followed the last summer's coup was so staggering, that the scale of the crackdown is so staggering, that this is the purge and crackdown that it's unseen in the past, you know, decades in Turkish history. Now we have more than 150,000 people were fired from their jobs, and they are not even allowed to apply for a public job again. Their passports are seized. They are ejected from public housing, and you know, if you're a police officer, you cannot be a private guard. If you are a teacher, you cannot apply to other schools. Or if you're a doctor, your licenses are revoked. And more than 50,000 people, 50,000 people are now in prison, and that include, you know, doctors, members of the judiciary, police officers, army officers, you know, academics. 164 of them are journalists, and Turkey is the world leader in the number of jailed journalists. You know, even quadrupling the second one, China.
That is
mind-boggling. I know.
Yeah. So Turkey, once again, so that people hear it correctly, Turkey is the number one country in terms of the media that is imprisoned, more than China.
Right. Right.
Right now, which is how many?
Four times more than it's 164. Actually, you know, I don't give, you know, exact numbers, because it's very difficult to give it up. And just every day we hear, you know, different stories. You know, two more people are being, you know, imprisoned, and then one is released, and then three others are in prison. So there's really no exact number. It's just, you know, changing almost like every week.
And that doesn't account for all of the journalists and others who have left the country.
Right. Exactly.
Like yourself.
Exactly. We have, I think, by my account, I think there are like more than 150 journalists who left the country only in the past 1 year, and most of them left since the military coup attempt. Now we have 164 journalists sitting in Turkish prisons, and we have 151 media outlets were shut down since the coup attempt, including my own newspaper, which was the best-selling newspaper in Turkey, selling over 1 million copies a day. And and we were like in print like since 1986. They erased all our online archive. More than 9 million articles were just gone. And it was they seized the government several months ago, and just 5 days after the military coup attempt, they just shut it down. Only on July 20th, like 5 days after the military coup attempt, they shut down 131 media outlets. That includes 45 newspapers, TV channels, 55 newspapers, 29 printing houses, and a lot, I think 23 radio stations. Again, the scale of the crackdown is so staggering, and the reason why Erdogan could go that far is because he gained tremendous international sympathy and huge domestic popularity after the coup attempt. He could cast himself to the world that, you know, he is an embattled president who was elected in free and fair elections, you know, five times now, and the military, which was not elected, is trying to topple him. And when it was failed, it was a huge boost for his popularity and allowed him to further crack down on dissidents.
It also was the trigger for constitutional reforms that will basically have, now that we know the result of the referendum, that has triggered a constitutional reform that gave him massive power.
Exactly. Well,
tell us about those constitutional reforms.
Right. Well, it's been a long-standing demand and ambition of President Erdogan. I think like since 2012, he always pushed for a new constitution and for the presidential system. He believed that the presidency in Turkey is a ceremonial figure, power position, he believed that since he's a president and there's a powerful prime minister, you can't imagine, you know, President Erdogan is ruling in a country that has a more powerful figure like prime minister. So he he couldn't change the constitution because he could never, you know, secure the political capital to do that in the past few years. And the military coup attempt was such a, you know, in his own words, a gift from God that that gave him huge popularity in the country. But as he, you know, cast his net too wide and you know, tried to include all other dissidents and opponents in his crackdown, when he went to polls on April 16th last month, a referendum on constitutional changes gave him sweeping powers, presidential powers. He now can declare a state of emergency. He can issue executive decrees. He can issue, you know, decisions bypassing the parliament. He can dissolve the parliament. And it gives a greater control to the president over the judiciary. So, and also it significantly weakens the checks and balances in the country. No Western leader called President Erdogan to congratulate, except President Donald Trump, just a day after that. All European leaders, you know, refrained to calling him or congratulating for the victory in the referendum, which was, you know, widely disputed, you know, marred by widespread irregularities and vote fraud. And a month later, President Trump invited, you know, Erdogan to White House. He was here yesterday, meeting with Donald Trump, and the European Union said that, you know, this constitution, there's no way that Turkey can become a member of the European Union. Now there are a lot of European politicians who are calling on the European Commission, which is kind of like executive body of the European Union, to suspend the membership negotiations. We started it in 2005 with the hope of becoming a full member, and President Erdogan made sweeping political and economic reforms, judicial reforms, in like 2 or 3 years, and then it was stalled, and his, you know, appetite for reforms has dimmed, because he had to also restrict his own power after 2010. So as soon as he eliminated military and hostile judiciary, he just, you know, stopped there.
This constitutional reform, which has now been approved, could also allow Erdogan to stay in power until 2029. Is that correct? Because there's
right.
presidential elections in 2019, and then he could be voted into 2 5-year terms.
Right, exactly. I mean, it's very similar here. When when we had a term limits during the Roosevelt's time, because that was enacted when Roosevelt was president, so he could run 2 more terms. And that's the case with Erdogan too. So he chose to do it in 2016, just, you know, 2 years after his election. And so we don't count this one. In 2019, he could be elected like for 2 terms, 5 years. And until 2029, he can stay in power. That's the constitution that allows him. And it's not only, he's not only becoming a president, but he's becoming a kind of a super president with extraordinary powers.
Some call it an elected dictatorship.
It is. It is. We had hope in the last month referendum that the Turkish people would vote no for these constitutional changes. It's because, you know, there are a lot of people, you know, tens of millions of people in Turkey who would not want Erdogan to go. They don't care about democracy or human rights or media freedom. What they care about is to make ends meet. And Erdogan was so successful in preserving that economic and political stability. And there are, you know, a lot of people who really would want Erdogan to stay there. But giving him more and more and more powers, it's something that even some of his supporters would question. So we thought that you know, those people would come out and vote no against him, and I believe they did vote no, but there were a widespread vote fraud documented by international observers, including Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, but they all fell on deaf ears. Which media will tell? Which judiciary will rule? I mean, all of them were controlled by President Erdogan. And no European leader said that was a referendum that met international standards and OECD standards for a free and fair election.
We're talking to Mahir Zeynalov, who's a journalist, a Turkish journalist, who has been reporting on the massive crackdown on Turkish journalists and the political system in general in Turkey after the failed coup of 2016. Mahir, what does this all mean for Turkish democracy? And obviously, Turkey is a key geopolitical country, particularly as we see the refugee crisis. It may have slowed down, but it's still there. Tell us a little bit more about the relationship between Turkey and Europe, and in particular with German, not the European Union, but with Europe, and as Turkey being a way for the refugee crisis to be, in a way, controlled. How does that relationship with Angela Merkel and Germany and Europe has been affected by all of this?
Right. You know, I'm trying to tell, you know, stories from Turkey to the Western audience, especially whenever I'm talking to our American friends, and trying to make the case, for Turkey that, you know, its democracy is, you know, eroding away, and Erdogan is kind of burying our hard-won freedoms and civil liberties. I know that many of them are saying, why should we care? But as Turkey is drifting away from human rights and democracy, it's also drifting away from the West. And Turkey has been a NATO member since 1952. It's been a stalwart ally of the United States and many European nations. But as Erdogan is making, you know, Turkey a more authoritarian country, it's also jumping on the Russian bandwagon too. I'll just give you one example. In the past 12 days, President Erdogan met with Xi Jinping of China, Vladimir Putin of Russia, Viktor Orban of Hungary, Modi of India, and President Donald Trump. So that's telling. It shows how President Erdogan is trying to wear Turkey away from the West, because Vladimir Putin or Xi Jinping don't lecture Erdogan about his human rights record, but the European countries do. And also he's, you know, increasingly questioning the if, you know, Western countries are a threat to President Erdogan's rule. And there are a lot of officials in President Erdogan's government who believe that the military coup attempt last summer was engineered by NATO, by the military envoys posted to NATO in Europe and the United States, and it's favorite pastime of Turkish newspapers to blare headlines of anti-NATO, anti-US sentiments. Geopolitical ramifications of the latest developments are troubling, because Turkey is now floating the idea of joining the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, that's a security bloc dominated by Russia and China, as an alternative to the European Union. And that's worrying, because Turkey doesn't have, Turkey cannot be Saudi Arabia, or Iran, become theocracy, and also deliver, goods and services to its people, because we don't have natural resources. We have to remain democracy. We have to have, free market, because our economy is a credit-driven economy. We have to make sure that we can borrow money from European banks and the Federal Reserve, or foreign investors will come and invest in our country. That's the way to create jobs in Turkey, and we have to remain free for Western markets. And 50% of Turkey's trade is with the European Union. And we are indebted to Europe and the United States with like $350 billion. So it's important that we have to remain in the European sphere. But I'm not sure if the Turkish government understands this.
So the story that you're telling us is, as you say, very worrisome. But also what's worrisome is that Erdogan still has quite high approval ratings. Is that correct?
That's right. I mean, one of the misconceptions in the West that, you know, Erdogan is an authoritarian leader who is shutting down Twitter and Facebook and jailing journalists, so he's not loved in his country. That's not true. Actually, most authoritarian leaders are very much loved in their countries, because there's no way that these people are getting alternative views. And
there's no opposition party. And
right,
no
exactly. Look, in 2014, we had three presidential candidates. One of them was Erdogan, and one of them was Selahattin Demirtas, a charismatic leader who was leading a pro-Kurdish party. Where is now? In prison for since November. It's 8 months already. So we had a referendum, and the major figure in the no camp was in jail. And most journalists who would campaign for the no are in prison. So there's no way that those people getting a fair view of what the other alternatives are. I don't think we have a problem in terms of information flow in the country, because most authoritarian countries are traditional societies, And we really have to teach them the values of democracy and human rights. So it's easier for Erdogan, you know, to say that, you know, we don't want democracy. There are a lot of people who would buy that. You know, it's something that, you know, unthinkable if you say it in the United States or in Europe. But in Turkey it sells, you know. I'm sure, you know, in many other, you know, third world countries it would sell too. So that's the reason how, you know, President Erdogan, who is cast as a leader who stands up against Israel, against the Western countries, and you know, he actually threw, you know, Nazi slurs against Angela Merkel and some other European leaders for refusing to allow the Turkish rallies during the referendum. So there are a lot of people who would buy those conspiracy theories, and I think that's the reason why you know, President Erdogan is so widely popular in Turkey. And as I said, I mean, it's not like coming out of the blue. President Erdogan did do a lot of reforms for Turkey. He made a country, you know, backward country into a regional economic powerhouse. And that's the reason why people give a lot of credit to him.
So you've painted quite a gloomy picture.
Yes.
Is there anything that gives you hope for the future of Turkey?
Well, Turkey is not another, you know, Middle Eastern country. We have a very vibrant middle class, but my worry is that, you know, when President Erdogan came to power, those folks who were like teenagers are now in their like 30, 35, who are just ruling the country. So now we have we may have a generation who has no idea how Turkey looked like before Erdogan. And that's, you know, worrying for me. But again, I think that we have a very educated middle class and a very vibrant civil society. And we are not, you know, another, you know, Iraq or Syria where you have like 3-4 generations of brainwashed by dictators. So, but, you know, when you exercise your power arbitrarily, and President Erdogan is doing that, it creates a fear of climate. You don't really know that how you will act, and you will get away, the jail or, you know, losing your job. So that fear of climate really reinforces the notion that, you know, let me remain silent. So Erdogan's support is a mile wide and inch deep. In any, you know, if he stumbles in any way, people will just kick him out. And also, I think that the economic stability and political stability, and I think these are reinforcing processes, are two things that are underpinning this government. Once, we have, if economy goes to south, I think the Turkish people will start to question his authority, because they keep him there because he is a guarantor of that political and economic stability. He always casts himself as an answer to the turmoil that followed the last summer's coup. And so I think we have a very vibrant civil society that will put him, bring him to account if he somehow stumbles. And, you know, until now, he always, as I said, you know, showed himself as an answer to all the troubles of Turkey, the series of, you know, terror attacks and the economic troubles. I think as he secured his power, now there's no one he can blame and play the victim. And people will, you know, start to question his rule. That gives me hope. But, you know, we have to wait and see.
Mahir Zeynalov, Turkish journalist and one of the leading voices in accounting for everything that's happening in Turkey. Mahir, a pleasure to have you with us. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And the best of luck to you and your country.
Thank you.
And to all of us listening, thank you for being there, and we'll be back with you next week.
Thank you for listening to the World Affairs Report, brought to you by the World Affairs Council of Pittsburgh in cooperation with KQV News Radio. The World Affairs Council is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that has been bringing the world to Pittsburgh for over 80 years. To learn more about the council and upcoming events, please visit worldpittsburgh.org. Be with us again next week when we take a 30-minute look at issues of global importance.